destroyed. I'll give you gold, or I'll give thee crying o'er the lonesome land so low. I'll give you gold, or I'll give thee the fairest of my daughters as she sails on the sea. If you'll sink them in the low and lonesome low, you'll sink them in the low and so. Swam, he swam till he came to the British Rovery. He had a little instrument fitted for his use. He bore 9 bows and he bore them all at once. But he turned upon his breast and back swam. He swam till he came to the golden willow tree. Captain, oh captain, come take me on board and do unto me.
Kids, it's Krusty the Clown. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. All right, where's my money? What? Chintzy college...
I left my heart in fire now, in the gold rush of the sun. Buenos Aires to Miami, I'm falling hard until I drown. I left my heart in Vienna, our glances by the candlelight. Love how he walks in his sombrero.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and welcome to this week's edition of In Black America and Ebony Spectrum.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
You know, my idea of creating a modern media company and really redefining what the modern newspaper is, was something that I think he also understood, and I think we hit it off, and that we had similar goals and aspirations. And so, again, it was the challenge, too. You know, I mean, I went to the Undefeated and people had really written it off for dead. And, you know, we built it and made it into something really, I think, that people could be proud of. And I thought that we got a big challenge here where we don't have as much penetration as we should have and we deserve to have. It's, you know, LA Times has been through a lot of difficult days before. So we have an opportunity. We have to build the place and get audience and build subscriptions. So part of it was the challenge of doing it, and the quality was always there journalistically. No one needed to tell me about the high quality.
Kevin Merida, executive editor of the Los Angeles Times. In June 2021, Merida took the helm of the largest news gathering organization in the West. The Veteran Journalist became the 19th editor of the 139-year-old newspaper. Previously, he was a senior vice president at ESPN and editor-in-chief of The Undefeated, a multimedia platform that explored the intersections of race, sports, and culture. Before ESPN, he spent 2 decades at The Washington Post. Prior to The Post, he worked at the Dallas Morning News as a special projects reporter, local political writer, and national correspondent based in Washington, D.C. In 2020, he received the National Association of Black Journalists Chuck Stone Lifetime Achievement Award. Over the years, Merida has proven he can flourish in the industry that has a small number of media executives that look like him. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Kevin Merida, executive editor of the Los Angeles Times, part 2, In Black America.
I think in a newsroom, you want to create energy, you know, that where people feel it, and then, man, here somebody did something that was cool. What can we do? You know, a happy newsroom for me is where people are constantly pitching new things, right, and constantly thinking, how can I make the place better? Because when you have that, then that's people claiming the place as theirs, because it's just, mm-hmm, as much as I enjoy being executive editor, it's not my Los Angeles Times, you know, it's the Los Angeles Times. And so everybody can attach their name to it and their vibe to it.
The Los Angeles Times is the largest metropolitan daily newspaper in America, with a daily readership of 1.4 million and 2.5 million on Sunday, more than 22 million unique LATimes.com visitors monthly. The Pulitzer Prize-winning Time has been covering Southern California for more than 133 years. In June 2021, Kevin Merida was selected to lead the Los Angeles Times into a new era. Before joining the Times, he was a senior vice president at ESPN and editor-in-chief of The Undefeated. Before joining ESPN, he spent 22 years at The Washington Post as a congressional correspondent, national political reporter, long-form feature writer, magazine columnist, and senior editor in several roles. Prior to The Post, he worked in the Lone Star State at the Dallas Morning News. He began his journalism career at the Milwaukee Journal. Mindful of the magnitude of his new position, he doesn't take it lightly. He's well aware that his success means others like him will be given an opportunity. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Kevin Merida.
The Dallas Morning News leadership, Ralph Langer and Bob Mong, and they wanted to diversify their management ranks, and so they had some shakeup of the masthead, and they asked me to come back to oversee foreign and national news coverage and to be an assistant managing editor. And so I ended up doing that for a couple of years before The Post called, you know, and it was not the first time, mm-hmm, that The Post had called. I thought maybe I had missed my window of coming to The Washington Post, to be honest. I thought, you know, I had turned them down at least a couple of different times, and I thought, man, I'm never gonna you know, they're gonna say forget him. But I had a really personal reason to get back to DC, because I had close relationship with my now wife, and we had a long distance relationship, and so we ended up, I ended up coming back, talking to the Post. By this time I had a pretty good relationship with the management there and was pretty well known. And so it just so happened I had a job covering Congress open, and I went back and talked to them. And I think I always felt that I had leadership ability. And the thing I say about leaders is that you can lead anywhere, right? You can lead from where you are. And even before I was in management, I was always part of bringing people together to talk to leaders, either individually to talk about how to diversify our newsrooms and improvements in them. And so I think it's possible to play a role. I love to write and report so much, so I was reluctant. And every time I put my foot in, I had this itch to get out, and to go back into writing. So, I kept doing that, putting my foot in here. And then it came that, we had a new editor, Marcus Brockley from the Wall Street Journal, who took over right at the end of the 2008 campaign, and, which I was covering is kind of a roving feature writer. And I thinking like, man, after this, I'm going to try to carve out a space to really write about the first African-American president. But he asked me to be national editor. And this time I really looked at it really closely. A lot of people prevailed on me. Some of my mentors and others said, look, your place needs you. It's given you a lot. And I thought at that time I was the first African-American editor to be national editor, Right. And so I did that, and that kind of set a path of, just continued being in management. I'm talking to you, as executive editor. It started really with that. It was a continuing, through 4 years of national editor and then almost 3 years of being managing editor. Marty Baron came in, and then, my decision to leave and go to ESPN to launch a startup called The Undefeated, now Anscape, and from there deciding to lead the Walt Disney Company after 5 years there as a as a senior vice president, editor in chief of The Undefeated, and join the LA Times. And that was largely through really, I would say the Soon Chong family, particularly Patrick and Michelle and his daughter Nika, and talking to them about what all they were trying to do with the Los Angeles Times, and my sense of their commitment to it and to the city. And here I am talking to you.
Talk to us about that day when you went to ESPN, because, I woke up, 2015, and you're leaving the Post, and I'm saying you're going to start this upstart, The Undefeated, that's going to blaze new trails with race and culture through sports. Talk to us about that.
It was really an agonizing decision for me because, I've been at the Washington Post for 22 years and I've done a lot of different things. And also being managing editor, I really love working with Marty Baron, really great experience. And we still remain close. And I just felt really connected to the newsroom there. And, sometimes when you're just at a place that feels home, it's hard to leave it. Particularly when you're usually in a position. I'm on the other side of that. I'm trying to get people to stay with us and not leave.
Right.
And so now people are trying to get me to not leave. But sometimes I think we were kind of in this era. It was in the early stages of really digital transformation. That had been happening certainly. And happening at the Washington Post, happening and elsewhere. But, I think slowly, methodically, but part of it happening was it was getting all of us to think differently about our careers and there was something about the chance to launch a startup. That was part of it that ESPN couldn't get off the ground. It was a new challenge. So it's a little bit like disrupting myself. We were in the age of disruption. And I thought I could just might as well maybe take a flyer and disrupt myself and try something different. It also was a reminder to me, this was the modern version of when we started a black student newspaper on campus at Boston University in a white, predominantly white campus.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the modern version of it, you know, to start something from scratch, build it, see what we could do with it, and just the challenge of it. And so I didn't regret that at all. Like, it was because I learned so much, you know, learned a lot about linear television. I never worked in television, learned a lot, certainly just about how the ecosystem of media is all kind of intertwined and connected. And we did so many different things. You know, we really were, we used to say this, you know, our managing editor, Raina Kelly, took over for me to say we were going to be content agnostic. And we were. I mean, we did a couple of best-selling children's books, and we did town halls. We brought Barack Obama to the largest HBCU for a televised special. You know, we had a televised special on gun violence in Chicago, South Side of Chicago. We did things that really nobody had done before we got there at ESPN. You know, we really pioneered a lot there, and I think in the country. We did music videos, original music. And then we just started finally able to break through right after George Floyd killed, unfortunately. You know, we were pushing to grow across the Walt Disney Company. It was really that time, around that time, that allowed us to spotlight more broadly with the company. And we were able to do some of the things that we wanted to do, including a record label, a book imprint, and now an independent studio. And that's all happened. And so I feel proud that we expanded and it's clearly on your way of building kind of a global black brand within the Walt Disney Company. And so all of it is beyond just like individual success, is personal and personal satisfaction. It's just learning. And I think we're all trying to do that as journalists. Journalism gives us a great opportunity to learn constantly. And for me, the years I spent at ESPN and at the Walt Disney Company was really a great growth period for me professionally and just knowledge wise and you know, because I'm doing things, thinking about marketing, thinking about documentaries, you know, all kinds of other things that I had not done, really more connected with advertising and revenue and monetization. You know, you're getting the full spectrum of what it would be to be a media executive, and with a small team too, and a relatively small budget. It also taught you that you can do some tremendous work with relatively small group and a relatively small budget. And it's a lesson that, you know, try to carry back here.
It's been a year since your appointment. What was it about the Los Angeles Times that struck your interest, considering that it had its own problems itself?
Well, again, I was struck by, you know, it was a really active courtship on the part of Patrick and Michelle Soon-Chung. And I was drawn to some of the ideas that, and the vibrancy that their daughter Nika had, and their commitment to the place. You know, it's, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people have bought newspapers and destroyed them, right? And,
right.
you know, certainly, you know, there have been, I say all billionaires are not created equal. You know, there have been, but I think they really saw the potential of what the LA Times could become. You know, this predates me. It was bought by Patrick before I got there, and he invested in it. He's shown a commitment to it. And so I think, you know, my idea of creating a modern media company and really redefining what the modern newspaper is, was something that I think he also understood. And I think we hit it off, and that we had similar goals and aspirations. And so, again, it was the challenge too. You know, I mean, I've been, you know, I went to the Undefeated and people had really written it off for dead. And, you know, we built it and made it into something really, I think, that people could be proud of. And I thought that we got a big challenge here where we don't have as much penetration as we should have and we deserve to have. It's, you know, LA Times has been through a lot of difficult days before. So we have an opportunity, and we have to build the place and get audience and build subscriptions. So part of it was the challenge of doing it. and the quality was always there journalistically. No one needed to tell me about the high quality. I was a consumer of the LA Times over the years, and even in the most difficult periods, they're producing some tremendous journalism. So knew a lot of the journalists and familiar with the reputations of others I didn't know. Yeah, just said, let me try something. And obviously the chance to be in the West Coast with my kids, you know, our two oldest sons been out here in the film business, and the oldest son has a grandson. So the opportunity to bring our media family together was also appealing to me and my wife. And here we are.
What will be some of your top priorities, and how will you go about achieving those goals?
Well, I think one of the biggest priorities was just to, and this is unglamorous, just to structure us, to really have structure and practices that represent the era we're living in now, you know, and how people are consuming. So, you know, to be more active and vibrant on social media, we created a social team, you know, a social content creation team called the 404, you know, which is in its early stages. We created a fast break desk, you know, for trending, breaking news and trending topics, and put a structure so that we're trying to drive coverage every day, intentionally put someone in charge of the day, you know, of what we're doing every day, you know, Shelby Grad. And so, you know, some of the structure we organize, we have an LA Times Studios that's supposed to be a place where we can take our work out beyond what we publish on our site we have a short doc series, and we're trying to develop some of our journalism into scripted and unscripted work, but we had to try to organize and structure it so that we could be successful there. We brought audio and video and what we do in studios together under a structure. And we, you know, we added some new beats, you know, tried some new kinds of areas of coverage. Have a big project on mental health this year. We're adding and, you know, growing, spreading, diversifying investigative ranks. We, you know, want to raise our ambition. That's a big driving priority of mine, to just up our ambition. I think we have a big newsroom. It's 550. It's not as big as the Washington Post or the New York Times, but we have enough to do any level of journalism. And I think we have to raise that level of ambition and do more work that is remembered for, you know, decades to come, you know, that level of work. And I think in every area we can improve and get better. We've, you know, another big priority was certainly we want to, you know, continue to make progress with diversity, equity, and inclusion, and really taking particularly in our management ranks. We've been very intentional about that and really widening it and adding more, and not confined to Latino journalists, but given the size of Latino population here in California, mm-hmm, and then in LA, half of the population, roughly close to half in LA and LA County. So really being active there, you know, certainly have the first Latino born and raised here in East LA, Hector Becerra, taking over the California staff, which is our largest staff, first Latina sports editor here, only one in the country in a major place, Ileana Romero. And so we've made some strides, head of audios, Latino. We've, you know, new managing editor, Shawnee Hilton's African-American, you know, so really diversifying ranks and adding to them. And then really trying to build a culture of a lot more of an open newsroom where there's more collaboration across department lines so that we can maximize the strength we have and really try to become the the modern media company that we say we are.
I got you. A couple of more questions, Kevin. How has or how will digital play a part in the refurbishing of the Los Angeles Times?
Well, digital's everything, right? Because that's where the consumption is. I think we're all in a digital world now. You know, I don't care if you are technically a newspaper, a magazine, or a cable network. We're all digital because that's how people are consuming. And so for us, I think it's doing more of the kind of work to reach digital audiences, trying to really constantly evaluate the user experience, how people are coming to our work, how can we reach them, more analytics and data to show what when we do things well, why they work, and when we don't do things well, why don't they work, and being more rigorous about studying our strengths and weaknesses and where we can get better. So I think, you know, making our work essential and broadening that work. So, you know, the things that are guides to what to do here, you know, list of where to go, where to eat, where to hike, you know, where the wildfire tracker, coronavirus tracker, you know, giving people things that are essential to for them to be able to enjoy their lives here and to know what's going on. So we've leaned into more of that, more utility journalism, and also just more experimentation, and to try to do that experimentation as effortlessly as possible, to try things so that we can see if they work. And if they do, let's do more of it. And if they don't, let's try something else. You know, we recently had a project called Behold launch, and, you know, it launched on an Instagram platform, but we also had a live event, which is basically black portraiture, where we were taking, you know, photos of a range of African Americans and showcasing them and highlighting them, and just and being able to let them see, not only let the world see, but let them see the imagery of themselves. And sometimes I think we can underestimate how powerful just visibility is, you know, to be seen, to be photographed, to be thought of as this is what I look like. This is what I stand for. This is me. This is how I express myself. And, you know, I started with staffers, you know, they put all this together, you know, if the reporter had suggested it and other people picked up the ball, you know, photographer Jason Armand, you know, leaned into it and others did. And so there's just, you know, I think in a newsroom, you want to create energy, you know, that where people feel it. And then, man, here somebody did something that was cool. What can we do? You know, a happy newsroom for me is where people are constantly pitching new things and constantly thinking, how can I make the place better? Because when you have that, then that's people claiming the place as theirs, because it's just as much as I enjoy being executive editor, it's not my Los Angeles Times, you know, it's the Los Angeles Times. And so everybody can attach their name to it and their vibe to it. You know, we created Image Magazine, you know, we remade it ineffectively and trying to turn it into around the clock brand as a culture brand. And we do a lot of cool things that you don't see anywhere else but there. And we want to keep building that, you know, like, let's try new things and then get them to the audiences that need to see them, that want to see them. And hopefully people can feel great about their place. Not great every single day. You know how it is, John. We have some days, but feel great about where they work and what they're contributing back, what they're giving back to those who need to have a really strong Los Angeles Times.
Final question, Kevin. You recently attended the NABJ and NAHJ National Convention. What knowledge did you drop on this next generation of journalists?
You know, it's funny you say that. You and I have been around a while. I mean, the main thing is, I think, to have some fun, and also just don't be in such a hurry. You know, one of the things I said was, man, ambition is great. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with having it, but don't let ambition ruin you, you know. Enjoy it along the way and learn as much and be curious. That's a famous line in Ted Lasso, which I love that series, be curious, not judgmental. Right. And they're really along the way, don't step over people to try to get to a rung of the ladder and, you know, accumulate a lot of titles, and then you figure out, yeah, I had a lot of titles, but what did I do with those titles? You know, but really learn the craft. Late Kobe Bryant, you know, go to places, go into the gym, find a gym wherever he was on an away game and work on some deficiency in your game or something you want to improve. And, man, because excellence along the way is, you can be excellent in something, then you have a great pathway, you know. But sometimes it takes a while to develop that excellence, you know. And
right.
And so don't be always skipping. Don't skip steps, you know. Don't be in such a hurry that you don't learn. Take time to learn what you need to do so that you're better prepared along the way. And always at every stage have some fun. And not only in our business have fun, but outside it, you know. Because the more well-rounded you are, the more that you get things feeding your soul and your mind, the better journalist you're going to be anyway. So
you got that right.
Yeah.
Any final comments, Kevin?
Man, the final comment is that when I got the note that you wanted to talk to me, man, first of all, I was honored. And that's an automatic yes, man, for you, because it's been a while, man. I hope we get to see each other, man. I've always been an admirer of your work, you know, and everything that you've done, you know, and the way you carried yourself and your career, man. And you know, it's an honor to be on the show with you. That's my final comment. I mean, your listeners, you know, I hope they're grateful to have you, you know. But I'm grateful for the friendship and just knowing you.
Kevin Meredith, executive editor of the Los Angeles Times. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America program, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archives of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
This is Rick Adams, host of Ebony Spectrum and the voice of Just a Thought. My Election Eve thought is this: election deniers, serial liars, abusers of women and children. You are in my thoughts and prayers, the Republicans quickly say. But cut the bull. Election Day, November 8th, is coming quick, and Republicans, let's face it, represent death. Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, gets his head banged in with a hammer by an attacker screaming, "Where is Nancy? Where is Nancy?" The same chant heard in the halls of Congress shouted by pro-Trump deniers of democracy last January 6th. Herschel Walker, the insult serial liar and pretend anti-abortion faker, is allowed to say he does not know a woman with whom he fathered a child, and he strong-armed into an abortion. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who suffered a stroke recently, is attacked because he now requires temporary use of a TV monitor to help him hear and read the questions posed. This in the age of Zoom. Can anyone say ADA, the American Disability Act? Wholesale attacks on a woman's right to privacy and control of her body, and the recently repealed state abortion laws that now force a 10-year-old rape victim to have the baby born of trauma, is an abomination. Remember, this is the same group of Republicans that at the Mexican border snatched children, including infants, from the arms of mothers without conscience and left them no way to be reunited as a family. This same group just dropped off immigrants who are in the country legally in another state with no lodging, dropped them in another state, no lodging, food, or water, and they were lured by the promise of non-existent jobs and boarded planes that were sent by Republican governors. The Republicans support everyone having the right to bear arms, but want to blame crime on the Democrats. But when you look at the stats, the majority of the 10 most violent states are so-called red states: Missouri, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Arkansas, South Carolina, and Louisiana, Republican territory all. Republicans don't support child tax credits, a living wage, or affordable college and health care. November 8th, votes for those who care about people make sense. Contact all your family and friends and get them to vote too. Let's deny the election deniers, serial liars, abusers of women and children. You know what to do. Until later, this is Rick Adams with Just a Thought.
Do you plan to have it in your budget to increase school safety, and how so?
I believe with the last budget, Wendy, not if I'm right, was it about $50 million put into increasing school safety with school resource officers, armed officers, to make sure we're protecting our kids. It is not impossible to protect our kids at school. They act like it is. Nancy Pelosi, well, she's got protection when she's in D.C. Apparently her house doesn't have a lot of protection. But if our lawmakers have protection, if our lawmakers can have protection, if our politicians can have protection, if our athletes, then certainly the most important people in our lives, our children, should have protection. I do want to get to the very bottom of who made the decision to mask our kids. Fauci, CDC, I think the school teachers union was in on it. I want to find out who made these decisions to shut our businesses down and shut our churches down. I want to have a commission to investigate COVID and how it was handled in this state and hand up any civil or criminal charges that need to be made, because we're not going to just forget what happened when our lives got turned upside down, when our businesses got shut down, when our grandparents and parents are forced to die alone in a nursing home, when our people who worked so hard were forced out of a job because they didn't want to get a shot that their boss wanted them to get. So I want to find out where a lot of these decisions were made, who was responsible. And if there is a way, and if there was some criminal activity, I think we need to look at that. Absolutely. This wasn't just some little petty theft. This was a theft of our freedom, our lives. This was the theft of our health. And I'm all for it. And I think that's why they're fighting against me.
The day after your debate with Dr. Mehmet Oz, you acknowledged that it wasn't easy to be up on that stage. You said that yourself. A week later, are you happy you did it?
I just always understood that it wasn't going to be easy. I mean, I'm 5 months into recovery from that, but I thought it was important that I show up, and I did. And at the end of the day, we did, I think, made some important points as well, true. And I think it also, reminded Dr. Oz the fact that he still believes, you know, with the same kind of abortion thoughts with Doug Mastriano, who believes that local political leaders need to be part of the decision between women and their doctors, as well true.
Lieutenant Governor, you said the other night at a fundraiser with President Biden that you would be better in January. Do you and your doctors think that you will have a full recovery by then?
I do believe that I continue to get and feel better and better.
Listen, we've heard a little from your doctor, but we haven't heard a lot. You're asking voters to trust you on your word that your health is good without the full story. So in the interest of full transparency for the voters, do you think it would help if you let your doctors brief the press before election night?
I think we've been pretty transparent. You know, we've had our doctors just be very clear that they're here, that we're able to and fit to serve. And from my point, you know, we've been also been very transparent in terms of showing up at a debate and very transparent about, you know, having events in front of thousands and thousands of Pennsylvanians for months. And I was, again, it was no secret that I was going to miss some words. I was going to mush some words together. And as we've been very clear in the debate and during this interview, I've been using captioning as well. True, I believe we've been pretty transparent to give all the voters to make it their choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, when the Republican Party of Georgia moved Herschel Walker from Texas to Georgia so that he could run for Senate, it's because change was taking too fast in the post-antebellum South. The state had been flipped blue, and there are some principalities that were not prepared for a black man and a Jewish man to go to Senate at the exact same time. So they figured that they would delude us by picking somebody who they thought would in fact represent us better with a football than with a degree in philosophy. They thought we were so slow, that we were so stupid, that we would elect the lowest caricature of a stereotypical broken black man as opposed to somebody who is educated and erudite and focused. Y'all ain't ready for me today.
Pastor Jamal Bryant breaking it down, actually pointing out exactly why these folks that are in support of Herschel Walker running as a Republican, the Republicans that have boosted him and put him in that position, you know, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, who's definitely, as we're going to see soon, is all on board. It shows what they think of their black candidate, why they chose him. It's just, you know, hidden just under that quick veil that Jamal Bryant pointed out there, but he wasn't done. Let's let him keep going.
Since Herschel Walker was 16 years old, white men been telling him what to do, telling him what school to go to, where to live, where to eat, where to buy a house, where to run, where to sit down, where to sleep, where to pay for abortions, where to buy a gun. And that you think they not gonna tell him how to vote? In 2022, we don't need a walker, we need a runner. We need somebody who gonna run and tell the truth about January 6th. We need somebody who gonna run and push for the cancellation of student loan debts. We need somebody who gonna run and make the former president respond to a subpoena. We don't need a walker. We need somebody who will be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding, knowing that your labor is not in vain. Georgia, I need you to know the slave Negroes y'all are used to don't live here no more. We can think for ourselves, function for ourselves, and vote for ourselves. Why? Because we don't need a walker.
Go off. How offensive is what many Republicans, I'm sure, would say. How dare you say we're controlling Herschel Walker and we just prop him up here for our own benefit? We don't do that. What's the matter with you? How racist, reversed racist of you? Enter Lindsey Graham.
What is it about this guy? He changes the entire narrative of the left. We're a party of racists, Sean. Me and you are racist. The Republican Party's racist. Well, what happens when the Republican Party elects and nominates Herschel Walker, an African-American black Heisman Trophy winner, right? Olympian. It destroys the whole narrative. John James, Tim Scott, Herschel Walker. Everybody in San Francisco is going to jump off a bridge if we elect this man. A black conservative beats a black liberal in Georgia. They're scared to death of Herschel Walker because if Herschel Walker becomes a Republican, maybe every other young child in America of color might want to be a Republican.
You see that? So, we're not the party of just propping up some random black person because he has a name that you guys might recognize. What we
JR, do, he named three other black dudes.
He gave you three. He said, all right, three. I got three for you. That's it.
We're not using Herschel Walker as a token and a prop up for our party to look like we are not a racist party that's following Donald Trump's rabid bigotry. We're not that. We just have a black guy right here in my face that I'm propping up because he might inspire more black people to be Republicans. That's exactly what we're talking about.
But as I said, the reason we're here, the real reason we're here, is because we wanted to feel what it's like to be on the ground in a state that everyone is looking to as Election Day approaches. Everyone, right? And you can feel it. You can feel it. I mean, you all live here. You know what I'm talking about. Like, you can't even forget Election Day is coming. Every single ad is political now. Every ad, every billboard is political. Everything, every flyer, every spam text that you get, everything is political. It's Halloween today. I bumped into a kid on the street dressed as Frankenstein. I was like, hey, what are you doing? He's like, the real monster is actually inflation. This Three Musketeers feels like a Two Musketeers. And as you know, there are two big races, two major races that everybody's watching, right? Two major races. First up, the governor's race, of course. Yes. With the seat currently occupied by Republican Brian Kemp, who's leading in the polls right now. Huh? Or is that for Halloween? Is that why you're booing? Is that what that is? Yeah, and he's running on a platform of making it harder to get an abortion, but easier to get a gun. And despite his policies, Brian Kemp is seen as a moderate. That's what I find really interesting. Yeah? All because he refused to help Donald Trump overturn the election, which is good, don't get me wrong, but that's how extreme politics has gotten in America, right? He's like, I don't think we should hang Mike Pence. And people are like, wow, this guy's got some moderate views. Yeah, he's a real moderate politician. But of course, the person trying to stop Kemp from getting a second term is the one and only Stacey Abrams. Yeah? Who, by the way, does it all. She writes books. She's a voting rights activist who played a big part in turning Georgia blue in 2020. And it turns out, she even has a budding acting career.
Today, we greet the president of United Earth. Welcome. I'm so pleased that you've come.
Okay, I see you, Miss Abrams. I see you set phases to cameo, eh? It's great. It's great to see that Stacey Abrams has gone boldly where no one has gone before, Paramount Plus. I like that. Now, we're going to be chatting to Miss Abrams right later on in the show, so we'll get back to that. But right now, let's focus on a Senate showdown that has ramifications even beyond Georgia. Right? And it's between Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock and the Republican candidates, Herschel Walker. Yes. Now Warnock's campaign is focused on abortion rights and expanding infrastructure. Right? But as Election Day gets closer, I feel like his campaign ads are now more focused on making sure that the race doesn't go any longer than it has to.
Guess who's coming to Thanksgiving?
Mom, we brought a friend.
Raphael Warnock!
That's right. I could be interrupting your Thanksgiving because if nobody gets 50% of the vote, there'll be a runoff, and nobody wants that to happen.
I'm Raphael Warnock, and we don't have to mix politics and Thanksgiving. That's why I approve this message.
Now, can you pass the sweet potatoes, please?
Can I just say, that is the most convincing way to get people to vote. If you don't vote, politicians are going to come to your house and hang out. Can you imagine politicians just showing up on Thanksgiving like, hi, I'm Herschel Walker. It's like, oh, hi, Dad. Wrong house. And by the way, I really need to understand it. What is going on in Georgia that Reverend Raphael Warnock is neck and neck with Herschel Walker? What is happening? Like, I know Walker is all neck, but what is happening? But every second thing the man says turns out to be a lie, right? He walks around with a fake police badge. Yeah. He pretended he was an FBI agent. Right? He claimed he was anti-abortion, even though he apparently paid for one. He claimed he had only one kid, even though he has like 1,000. Oh, and he told people he graduated in the top 1% of his class at the University of Georgia. And then it turned out he never graduated at all. At all. Like, at this point, I want to meet the Herschel Walker that Herschel Walker thinks he is. Right? Because at this point, everything is like he treats real life the way we treat dating apps. You know, just like in your profile, like, I'm one of the tallest people you'll ever meet. I founded my own industry and my mom lives with me, not the other way around. Yeah. But the bigger thing about Herschel Walker for me isn't all the lying and the hypocrisy. He's also just weird. He's a strange guy. You know? Like, and if you don't believe me, watch him give one of my favorite answers ever in politics, right? This is what he said when he was asked about the biggest problem facing America today.
What do you see as some of the biggest problems going on in our country today?
I think some of the biggest problems going on in our country today, we have so many celebrities telling people that they can't do it. Telling a lot of people, you can't do it. Like, you got to feel bad for yourself, feel sorry for yourself, which is sad to me because when they made it, they've done it, but they're telling you can't do it. And it's like, God, you did it. Why they can't do it?
Okay. First of all, that was the sleepiest interview I've ever seen. It's like if Ambien had a podcast. What was that? The only reason those two should be in the same room is if Ben Carson is doing brain surgery on Herschel Walker. There's no other reason they should be talking to each other. No, because I'm sorry. He says the biggest problem that America's facing right now is celebrities telling people they can't do it. The biggest problem? The biggest problem. You think the average American right now is saying, I know inflation is bad right now, but the bigger issue is that Vin Diesel has never told me to follow my dreams. I could have owned a bakery by now. Could have been baking for family. And look, I get it, all right? Some people will be like, you're a celebrity. You're not objective. Well, I guess so. Maybe I'm missing something here. You know, maybe I am. And so if I am, in case I've been too discouraging to the American people, let me say this. In America, you can do anything. Just like Herschel Walker. If you want to be an FBI agent, you claim you're an FBI agent. If you want to graduate valedictorian, just tell people that it happened, because it did. If you want to be the father of one despite having fathered four, then by God, be the father of one despite having fathered four children. That is the American way. Yeah. The point is, there are many major races that are going on this year, and they're really close. You know this. America knows this, right? A week from now, Herschel Walker might actually be claiming victory. I mean, he'll be doing that no matter what, but he could actually win for real. And that's why, with 1 week until the election, the Democrats have pulled out the big guns. Yeah, Netflix's very own Barack Obama. This race is so important, it even got Obama off the beach. He was down here in Georgia over the weekend, and he brought that Obama swag with him.
Some of you may not remember, but Herschel Walker was a heck of a football player. But here's the question. Does that make him equipped to weigh in on the critical decisions about our economy and our foreign policy and our future? Let's do a thought experiment. Let's say you're at the airport and you see Mr. Walker and you say, hey, there's Herschel Walker, Heisman winner. Let's have him fly the plane. You'd want to know, does he know how to fly an airplane?
Wow. Wow, really? Really, President Obama, really? You're gonna say that about a man who graduated in the top 1% of pilot school? How dare you?
A lot of people don't know this about me, Herschel, but I was in Top Gun. That movie was about me.
My name in the 80s was Pete Maverick. I love how Obama roasts you with like that signature swag. He makes it sound so polite, but he's roasting the shit out of you. The last time I checked, you didn't have any brains. But it was fun. It was fun to see Obama at it again, wasn't it? Huh? People always love seeing him come out. You know, gets the crowd fired up, gets everybody excited. You know, that's what you get from him in a race. You know, that's why they don't send Joe Biden. You know, you don't get the same thing from him. It's true. Joe Biden wants to do it. He's always like, I'll go give a speech. And everyone's like, no, please, sir, please. You're needed in Washington. There's a 1,000-piece puzzle we need your help on. You go on, sir. He's like, I used to know a guy named Puzzle. Yes, you did, sir. Yes, you did. Go on. You just solved that, sir. So at the end of the day, it's all going to come down to the votes. All right? Who votes? Who doesn't? Which is going to be a little bit harder. I don't need to tell you this, but you know this, because last year, Georgia state Republicans passed a very controversial bill, right? It was a law, SB 202, which created all kinds of new obstacles to voting. Fewer drop boxes, shorter absentee voting windows, and it's even illegal to hand water to people waiting in line. Yeah. I mean, luckily, you can still hand out Dasani, because legally, that's considered sewage. But at that point, I mean, people would rather die of thirst. Now, Georgia Republicans claim that this bill was about voter fraud, but we all know the real motivation, right? And they say it's about fraud, right? It was about trying to suppress the voter turnout. We get it. I mean, because at some point, they even tried to limit early voting on a Sunday. Hey, why Sunday? We know why. Because of souls to the polls, right? They have an organization that makes sure that they get people going straight from church on a Sunday to go and vote. And I gotta say, that's particularly messed up. How are you gonna take that away? Sunday voting was the one day when black church was only 5 hours instead of 10. But can I tell you what I've loved about being here in Georgia is watching the news and realizing that the voter suppression strategy might have backfired, because it turns out all these new restrictions are just motivating Georgians to vote even harder.
Georgia continues to see a record turnout for early voters in a midterm. So far, more than 1.6 million people have already cast their votes in Georgia, and election officials expect that number to surpass the 2 million mark this week.
I think a lot of people are really motivated for a bunch of different reasons. And I think democracy is definitely on the table.
People have fought for us to have the right to vote. So we are persistent about coming to vote early.
You know, a lot of people lost their lives for us to have that privilege to come out and voice our opinion.
I would have came out. If it was snow on the ground, I would have came out to vote.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The voter suppression people thought that they could stifle the vote, but all they've done is motivate people to vote earlier than ever. And let me tell you something. That's how you know. That's when you know you've messed up and you've made black people angry, when we arrive early to some shit. That's when you know some shit's about to go down. When black people are like, hey man, you're only supposed to get here at 12. It's 11:30. It's like, yeah, but we need to handle some shit first. Why are you early? You're about to find out. But I just wanted to remind you, whether it's early voting or waiting in line or mailing in your ballots, everyone here in Georgia needs to get out there and play their part. Everyone's going to play their part. Including myself, because as a celebrity, I need to tell you, you can do it. You get out there and you vote early, or you vote on election day. You bring your own water, and if the lines are long, you stay in that line. Because if you don't, Raphael Warnock's gonna come straight to your house, and he's coming for those sweet potatoes.
Well, we've heard many different segments on the program today. We've heard segments from The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Watch This TV, The Young Turks, Now This News, and NBC News, as well as MSNBC, which I think I mentioned. So, we all have a clear choice. We have many choices, either here in Pennsylvania, locally here in the Pittsburgh area and across the nation. So it's up to you to go exercise your right to vote and to make your choice coming up on Tuesday, November 8th. We're going to thank you for listening to the show once again, and I hope you enjoyed the part two of In Black America with our guests on In Black America with Kevin Morita, the executive editor of the Los Angeles Times. And we'll see you next week. Take care and be safe.
Yeah, yeah. Whoa, hold on. Walk it like I talk it. Walk it, walk it like I talk it. Walk it, walk it like I talk it. Woo. Walk it like I talk it. You walk it like I talk it. Walk it, walk it like I talk it. Walk it, walk it like I talk it. Woo. Walk it like I talk it.
Hey.
Walk it like I talk it. Walk it, walk it like I talk it.
Walk it,
walk it like I talk it. Walk it, walk it like I talk it.
Woo.
Walk it like I talk it.
Talk it.
Walk it like I talk it.
Hey.
Walk it like I talk it. Walk it, walk it like I talk it.
Yeah.
Take my shoes and walk a mile. Something that you can't do.
Woo. Hey.
Big talks of the town. Big boy gang moves.
Gang moves.
I like to walk around with my chain loose.
Chain, chain.
She just bought a new ass, but got the same booze.
Same booze.
Whipping up dope scientists.
Whip it up, cook it up, cook it up.
That's my sauce where you find it.
That's my sauce when you look it up, find it.
Adding up checks, no minus.
Adding up, add it up, add it up,
yeah. Get your respect in diamonds.
Ice, 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 ice.
I bought a plain Jane, roll it. These niggas bought they fame.
Woo.
I think my back got scoliosis, cause I swerved the lane. Heard you signed your life for that brand new chain.
I heard.
Think it came with stripes, but you ain't straight with the game.
Gang, gang.
Walk it like I talk it.
Walk it.
Walk it like I talk it.
Walk yeah.
It. Walk it like I talk it.
Talk it.
Walk it like I talk it.
Woo.
Walk it like I talk it.
Walk it.
Walk it like I talk it. Walk it. Walk it like I talk it.
Talk it.
Walk it like I talk it.
Let's go.
Versace, Versace, we stay at the mansion when we in Miami. The pillows Versace, the sheets of Versace, I just want a Grammy. I've been so quiet, I got the world like, what the fuck is he planning? Just make sure that you got a backup plan, cause that shit might come in handy. Started a label, the album is coming September, just wait on it. This year I'm eating your food and my table got so many plates on it. Hunted this TV at my house, I sit back like, damn, I look great on it. I do not fuck with your new shit, my nigga, don't ask for my take on it. Speaking of lingo, man, this for my nigga that trap out the bendo. This for my niggas that call up Fernando to move a piano. Fuck all your feeling, cause business is strictly financial. I'm always the first one to get it, man, that's how you lead by example. Versace, 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 Versace,
Versace.
Word in New York is the Dykeman and high schools are calling me Poppy.
Ooh.
I'm all on the low, take a famous girl out with it, no paparazzi.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy, so we show them how, and we tell them, with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids need to know the dangers and how to avoid them. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids, because when you talk, they hear you.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for. Harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet. Or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community, at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Breast cancer calls to mind self-exams and mammograms. But did you know the most fatal form of breast cancer does not have a lump?
No lump. Still cancer. You heard me right. No lump can still be cancer. Inflammatory breast cancer, IBC,
does not show up on a mammogram and often strikes women in their 30s.
So learn about IBC. Any sudden change in the breast is cause for a full and proper exam.
www.theibcnetwork.org or find them at the IBC Network Inflammatory Breast Cancer on Facebook.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy, so we show them how, and we tell them, with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs.
Jazz Corner here on WRCT Pittsburgh.